in 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 22.
Yes, a lot of weeks.
A lot of weeks. So, as always, please make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Find us on SoundCloud. Of course, remind everyone, as always, to please give us a nice review on iTunes if you do so, and leave the name of a movie you would like us to review. We will mention your review and read your review out loud and talk about your movie on our reboot section, which we have two movies in our reboot section. The first comes from Caroline Medlock on April 17, 2016. She gave us five stars. Anyway, she says, one of my favorite movie podcasts. Thank you guys for doing comprehensive reviews without spoilers. Settle this paradox for me. That's a big order. But Armageddon, 1998. This is one of those mini Michael Bay movies that people completely trash, but it's still included in the Criterion Collection. Thoughts? Well, we're going to give you some thoughts, Caroline Medlock, on Armageddon in our reboot section. Our second one comes from I'm a Citizen. Quality discussion, 5 stars. Thank you, I'm a Citizen. I enjoy this podcast. Thank you, I'm a Citizen. I always liked reading the Deadspin posts, and I'm always up for intelligent discussion on films. I'd also humbly request that Road to Perdition be included as a rewatch. Last great turns from Paul Newman in front of the camera and Conrad L. Hall behind it. I've always felt it was underrated. Well, we'll see whether we confirm your longtime feelings when we talk about Road to Perdition this week. Also, the last thing I want to get into before we get into our big movie this week is it's almost July. It's almost July, which means we are doing our end of the first half of 2016 movies, where we're going to discuss each of us are going to pick our 6 favorite films of 2016 so far. We want to make sure we get to everything we can. So if you have any recommendations on movies that you think have been underseen or underrated, please let us know. Someone actually just recommended, this is kind of a sad little moment, to Green Room, which we were talking about this the day that Anton Yelchin, the star of Green Room, an actor we have liked very much in several things, from Like Crazy to The Beaver to the Star Trek movies, he died tragically in a car accident. And Green Room is one of those movies that we have both seen. I think we even Grierson discussed on this podcast. That's another movie. The movies like that you think were really good that were under-discussed, please holler that. How many do you feel like you're behind now, Grierson?
The list is getting bigger. I think I'm at like 15 right now. It's actually kind of depressing. I know that when we have that conversation at the end of this month, there will still be movies I have to still see. So, but I think it's like 12 or 15 at this point.
All right, well, add some more, people. Give us some more so we can have more homework. And, of course, rest in peace, Anton Yelchin. Okay, two happy things. We're this week's big release. We're only going to do one major big release this week. It is Finding Dory.
Somewhere. My family! They're out there somewhere. I have to find them.
Something important? What?
Something about a clam or...
No.
No, an oyster?
No.
Mollusk?
No.
Something?
No.
I don't know.
No clam.
All right, Finding Dory, directed by Andrew Stanton. That's right, isn't it, Grierson?
Absolutely.
Who directed the first one? Directed the first Finding Nemo. It features the voices of Ellen DeGeneres, Albert Brooks, Ty Burrell, Diane Keaton, Eugene Levy, several people. It, of course, is the sequel to Finding Nemo, which came out 13 years ago, is that right?
2003, the summer of 2003, that's correct, yes.
So the movie, of course, follows Dory, who from the first film was kind of the comedic relief character. In this film, she kind of picks up a little bit where we came in Finding Nemo. We see a lot of her backstory heading into that moment. It basically makes the supporting character the main character. Dory is trying to find her parents, who she's like kind of begins to come back, and some memories come back. She remembers that they are ultimately, or they at least she came from this theme park. Marlin and Nemo come with her on this adventure. They meet an octopus. They listen to a lot of Sigourney Weaver. So as a big Finding Nemo loyalist, what did you think? First off, when you initially heard they were doing a sequel, because you know, we discussed Pixar's kind of increasing sequelitis a little bit, particularly with a movie that you were so fond of, were you worried about it, and ultimately how did it pay off for you?
I was massively worried. And not only am I a Finding Nemo fan, I'm a big Andrew Stanton fan. And you know, he made Finding Nemo. He did WALL-E. One of the best Pixar movies. And then he went away and did John Carter And that was kind of a disaster, as it was well chronicled in The New Yorker when they did a profile of him before that movie came out. And so the fact that he was returning to Pixar, I was happy about that. But you know, it's been 13 years between movies. It does sort of feel like a band that broke up to do side projects, and those side projects didn't turn out, so the band miraculously decides to get back together to do kind of a comeback tour. My worry with Finding Dory is that that is what this was going to be. Sort of a, we know this will be a hit, so let's just do one of these type of movies. I really like Finding Dory. You know, this is a movie I'm kind of two minds about. I watch this movie and I acknowledge that there probably is not a reason for this movie to exist. 13 years after the fact, I'm not sure, though I think they do a pretty impressive job of giving Dory this whole story. She's searching for her parents. And as you said, Marlin and Nemo are kind of along for the journey as well. And they have kind of an emotional arc that they do as well in this film. That being said, I'm still not sure that there needs to be this movie. So for what is essentially a unnecessary sequel, it is really fun. It is very funny. And I think in terms of recent Pixar movies especially, I feel like what Finding Dory does well, beyond everything else, is it kind of says, okay, everybody, what do we as a company at Pixar do really well? We do kind of emotional, tear-jerking stories. We do kind of whiz-bang action. And we do jokes. Lots and lots of jokes. They tend not to be very pop culture-y or kind of hip and witty in that way. They're just kind of clever, funny, cheerful jokes. Let's just do all of that in this movie. At the same time, this movie expands on what Finding Nemo was about, which is that in a scary, frightening, terrible, awful world, you have to be optimistic anyway, because that's a choice that you can make. And if you make that choice, good things can still happen to you. You know, for a movie that basically jettisons most of its supporting characters from the first movie and creates a whole new fleet of new characters, I think that transition works pretty well. I think Ed O'Neill as the aforementioned octopus is really fun in it. I think Idris Elba as a... He's a sea otter. Is that what he is?
I think so, yeah.
What is that? Yeah. I think he's really funny. I think everybody who's a new character in this, they're all pretty funny. They don't get in the way of the main story. I think the action sequence that ends the movie is really well done. Very, very clever. And actually, I think one of the better things that Pixar has done in quite some time. You know, again, like, this to me is like the later era of a band that you really like. And it doesn't necessarily like reinvent the wheel, but it does everything that that band does really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. I like it as well. I don't think I like it as much as you do. If just, it does feel, while it, you know, it's not a straight rehash, you know, doesn't have the Neighbors 2 problem, which is, this is just that movie you saw, but again, I also think the strongest part of this movie is the relationship that she has with her parents and kind of the flashbacks. One of the things I mentioned in my review, I think this is a movie that's going to have a lot of power, particularly for families with special needs children. I think that is without question and a subtext to the film that is meant to be there in the idea that, you know, the we see in flashbacks the Dory's parents, voiced by Eugene Levy and Diane Keaton, they understand very early on that they need, like, their child is special and there is going to need some extra skills to be able to survive in the world. I do think that's something that's going to prove, I think, very relevant and something easy to very relatable to a lot of parents with special needs children. I think the movie, I think that's no, like, you know, it's one of the things I really like about Pixar is they accept the responsibility of their movies, if that makes sense, because it's something that is almost a commentary on the first film. In the idea that it's the memory thing is kind of played as I think a funny joke in the first film, but this actually takes it a little bit more seriously and takes it as an affliction and takes it, but not so much an affliction, excuse me, but something that is more, that's something that makes her who she is and is something that the parents understand to deal with and learn to not only love but make work for her. And so I think that works very strongly. I don't think the Marlin and Nemo story is really that interesting or really all that different than the first story.
Yeah, and I wouldn't disagree with that. I think that's absolutely correct. And that is, I think, one of the liabilities of this movie is that they are sort of the damsels in distress, essentially, in this movie. I do think the one thing that is different and that is sort of worthwhile in this movie is that Nemo, in a certain way, is more of a character in terms of how he interacts with his father, because they didn't interact very much in the first movie. Then in some ways, this movie is kind of about how Nemo and Marlin deal with their relationship after what's happened in the last movie. I agree that it's not nearly as strong as the Dory stuff. The only thing I think that hurts this movie is that because you remember them being more central and important in the first one, they feel like they're not doing as much. And that's, you know, again, what a great problem to have.
Now, okay, let's talk about this car chase at the end. And because I agree that as an action sequence, it's extremely well done. It's well choreographed. It's well paced. It's well put together. This is, and I recognize that every time I say this, because I said this before about a Pixar movie, every time I say this, I sound a little like an adult being like, well, actually, a fish would never be able to survive out of water for that long in like a kid's movie. I'm fully aware of this. But I do think there is a fine line of this notion of how much in the world of these movies is happening outside of human awareness and how much, and a lot of this is the original Toy Story problem, which is when you shut the door, this is what's happening. And there, I think there is this certain idea in the best Pixar movies where this is all, you know, some of them like are full on like, hey, here is a rat that can talk and talk to humans and makes food in a beautiful French restaurant. But I think the strong ones, like the original Finding Nemo, like the Toy Story movies, like WALL-E, the idea that this is taking place in a universe that we don't see, and therefore this is what's really going on. I'm willing to see that line crossed a little bit. It's crossed in the original Toy Story, for crying out loud. I do think when there's a moment where an octopus is driving a car, we've crossed that line.
Yeah, and that's why I was referencing a horse beforehand. That is a moment while watching it, I said, yes, this is somewhat different than what Pixar normally does. I just really don't care. And I think it's entirely based on a case-by-case execution question. And for me, it's done so well, it's done so zippily that it didn't bother me. And when the big song cue comes up, I laughed pretty hard. And I know other people find it kind of, you know, kind of annoyingly kind of clever or precious. I thought it was really funny.
One mistake I made my review that I did not realize until I saw the movie a second time was that, like, it's not a manual transmission. I'll give him that. It's an automatic transmission. So there. So yes. There's that. He's not actually upshifting. This is not Bullet. He's not upshifting and downshifting. But nevertheless, that's I will say there's a little moment like, all right, I don't know about the octopus driving the car.
Is this your Roger Ebert complaining about War of the Worlds and the tripod spaceships?
I'm just saying that, like, in the movie, like, listen, to me, another time, a great example of this is in WALL-E when Fred Willard is in it. Like, that is the human universe and interacting with this one hand in hand. And to me, again, I know this is a little pedantic, a little dorky, but also I feel like if you've asked us to invest in that, then and you end with an octopus driving a car. Not just driving a car, hijacking a car. Hijacking a car, learning to drive immediately, understand it. Like, I was even to accept, okay, fine. Dory's been able to read for a couple of movies. Fine, I'm with it. But to me, it was a bridge too far for me.
I get it. And even while I watched it, I thought, yes, this is kind of crossing a line, but I found it so entertaining. I thought the pleasure this is giving back to me, I prefer that to my pushing back against this thing. So,
who's your favorite voice actor in this? We'll wrap up with this.
Of the new people, you mean?
Then in that case, I want to take a brief moment to talk about how Ellen DeGeneres is legitimately very good in this. It makes me feel like she should act more. Like, I think she's very good. Because she was very funny in the first one. But, like, there's, like, an emotional resonance to her. And I think Dory, like, takes actually her facial expressions very well. And I actually feel like it's actually, as far as voice performance goes, a pretty solid one.
For me, what's funny is to think that when the first movie came out, she was, you know, she'd had a TV show. She'd, you know, starred in live action movies. But, you know, Albert Brooks of the two people was the bigger name of the two. You know, 13 years later, she's hosted the Oscars a couple times. She has, like, this big daytime talk show. She's beloved. I mean, she's a beloved personality. And she is really good in this. I think Ed O'Neill is really good. I was sort of happy because I've been a long time Sunny in Philadelphia fan. And so Caitlin Olsen getting something to do outside of that show, I was thrilled. And Ty Burrell, I think, is also really funny. Mm-hmm. Sigourney Weaver, that joke, that running joke in that movie is really, really tremendous. And for me, a testament of how much I like this movie was I kept thinking, I hope they go back to that joke again. And when they did a couple other times, I thought, oh, that makes me happy.
All right. Well, Grayson, what ultimately do you give this? I like it a little less than you, but I still think it's very solid. I think this is a very solid, perfectly respectable, solid B.
I give it a very low A minus. This movie's
You're really into this.
This movie's really, really, really fun. I would say in terms of pure pleasure, this is my favorite Pixar movie since WALL-E.
Wow. Wow. Well, let's get into that then, because one of the things I want to talk a little very briefly, you and I did Pixar rankings for Vulture back in the day, been a while now. It's like pre Good Dinosaurs, right after Inside Out, right?
Correct. Yeah,
right after
Inside Out.
So they Vulture asked us to put in Good Dinosaur and Finding Dory to the rankings since we had done that since we did the rankings last time. You put Finding Dory 8th.
Yes, I was predicting that you would not like it as much as I did. So I would put it in a good solid 8 right behind Inside Out, but above Ratatouille.
Okay, so and you are allotting for me being a little down on it. So my question for you is, do you think it's better than Inside Out?
I think on a story level, Finding Dory is much more satisfying than Inside Out. I think Inside Out is incredibly emotional, and I think its first act and its third act are really, really tremendous. To me, its second act has a problem that you and I talk about a lot in terms of Up, which is, and now we're going to go on a quest. And to me, the quest in Inside Out, though Bing Bong is a great character, what they do along the way, I don't find as interesting until they actually get to the end and there's the real kind of emotional stakes at the end. Finding Dory, I find a much more satisfying beginning, middle, and end of that movie. So I do think it's better than Inside Out, yeah.
All right. It was funny because I like Inside Out a little bit less than you, and I would not put it above Inside Out. So I think that you put it in the right spot on the list. Just in case you guys are all curious, when we do these lists, we debate them quite a bit and ultimately come to some sort of consensus that deals with our natural competitiveness. But we ultimately, here's where we landed on our top five. Top six, actually, because I conceded a lot to put this movie number six. Number six is Toy Story 3, which I would probably put a little bit higher. Five is The Incredibles. Four is Toy Story 2. Three is Finding Nemo, which I probably wouldn't put quite that high. Two is Toy Story, but one thing we both agreed on and was an easy one to put number one, we both have WALL-E as number one. I absolutely still believe that.
Yes, I do too. And it's funny because I wouldn't put The Incredibles as high. So yeah, what's interesting for us with Pixar movies is that we both really love their movies, but we have on the top of our lists some pretty different ones.
Also, I like Cars too. So like that also puts me on the outside of this. So there is a great piece I wrote for the old Yahoo site that was deleted by the internet sands about how I think of everybody hating Cars 2 was more about critical groupthink than necessarily that it's not a good movie. But let's not go down that realm again. Haven't we suffered enough? We do both agree that Brave stinks.
Yeah.
All right, Grayson. So that is Finding Dory. So are we going to get, Finding... Is there one more down the line? If they were to spin off one more character to do another one of these in 10 years, which one do you want?
No.
Hey, Mr. Grumpy Gills. When life gets you down, you know what you gotta do?
I don't wanna know what you gotta do.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim, swim.
Dory, no singing.
Dory. I love to swim in.
Dory.
When you want to swim, you want
See,
to
See, I'm gonna get stuck now with that song. Now it's in my head.
Sorry.
All right, so before we get into our reboot section, by the way, I want to mention that one of the things that's fun about doing this podcast, of course, we talk about movies that are the big releases of the week, but you do these podcasts long enough and the big releases of the week become the big DVD releases. So I wanted to, in case, now that these movies are either streaming or available through iTunes or Amazon or on DVD, I wanted to just remind you, if these are movies that all come out recently, we've done podcasts on all these movies. So our first episode, which was 13 hours talking about Michael Bay, that if you want to go back and see how bad the sound was and how terrible we were, You can go back to that one. Deadpool, Zoolander 2, Hail Caesar, The Witch, Triple Nine, Knight of Cups, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, 10 Cloverfield Lane just came out on, it's. I think that is destined to be a movie people are going to be talking about for a while. Go back and listen to some of our old podcasts on that one. Midnight Special, which we were very excited about, is also out on DVD and streaming now. So make sure to go back and listen to some of those, because now I can never tell when making this podcast whether it's for people who have seen the movie or have not seen the movie. We obviously don't spoil anything, but I think there's something to, once you've seen the movie, go back, go to our iTunes page, download some of the old podcasts if you've seen the movie since then. Hopefully you'll find it a good time.
Yeah, also say about Midnight Special, when we asked on Twitter for people who follow us what movies they liked the most in the first half of this year, Midnight Special was, I think, sort of the consensus pick.
All right, now it's time for our reboot section. We kick off our reboot section with Armageddon.
What is this thing?
It's enormous.
It's an asteroid, sir. It's the size of Texas, Mr. President.
What kind of damage?
Total, sir.
My God.
Nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
What do we do?
We blow this thing up from the inside.
How?
We drill. We bring in the world's best deep core driller.
The United States government just asked us to save the world.
I'm with you.
Of course I'm in. I can't let you go up there alone.
All right, so the movie is Armageddon, came out in 1998, starring Bruce Willis, Billy Bob Thornton, Ben Affleck, Liv Tyler, Steve Buscemi, and all sorts of mid-90s indie movie actors. That was one of the things that really jumped out at me watching this movie again. I was like, oh, there's Peter Stormare. Oh, my gosh. Oh, look, there's all of these fun indie actors. William Fichtner, Owen Wilson.
Yeah. Back in you have like a mini Fargo reunion in here, and yes, it's
So this is, so I know the, when you heard that we were doing Armageddon, everyone, you're like, why? You're not doing Deep Impact? No, we're not doing Deep Impact, the movie that, the other Meteor movie. A couple things I want to kick us off on. First, whew, pretty long. That movie is long. That movie is 2.5 hours long. I mean, it's a freaking long movie.
Hey, it's the end of the world, man. Come on.
It is the end of the world. I'd like to note, by the way, just to give you an idea, because, you know, we discussed in our very first podcast, we just Michael Bay and kind of his politics, you know, and he still to this day claims, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a conservative, I just make these movies that are about America, and so on, so on, so on. I'd like to note, this is not something I've remembered at all, but literally the first time we meet Harry Stamper, the lead character, the hero character, played by Bruce Willis, he's literally hitting golf balls off his boat at Greenpeace workers.
Yep. I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure we can.
I don't believe you, Michael Bay. There's also, yes. Yeah. So honestly, like, all told, what'd you think watching this again now 16 years later, 18 years later?
When I saw Armageddon, I saw it maybe opening night, definitely opening weekend. I thought it was not so great. I didn't hate it, but I thought it was just kind of like, oh, this does not bode well for where his career is going in terms of just how like gargantuan it is. Though it's hilarious now to think a 2.5 hour movie seems long since most big studio blockbusters are that long. So I watched it this time, and maybe it's the residual effect of suffering through his Transformers movies. I gotta say, I found this movie downright charming. I found it downright charming, and sounds glib and dismissive, but I have to say, legitimately, I found it kind of charming. There's a lot of Michael Bay-ishness in this movie that one has to suffer through, and boy, is there a lot. But I actually thought this is maybe the only one of his movies where the ludicrousness of its plot actually has a weird, makes a weird kind of sense in a certain way. Like, okay, get this. There are oil riggers. These are the only people who can fly into space and drill a meteor to put a nuclear like weapon into it to blow it up, because that will send the meteor to both sides, or like to both sides of the Earth, so it won't hit the Earth. The movie sells that well enough that I went, okay, that's fine. And then that group of guys who, you want to talk about like the politics of a movie, those guys, I was watching this movie thinking, oh, they'd all vote for Trump, wouldn't they? I found it pretty darn pleasurable, and I think it is actually tighter, more compelling, better put together than any of the Transformers movies. It actually has, you know, there's a certain amount of sort of nonsense stakes in this movie. You know, the whole world is threatened, but does anybody really feel that while watching this movie? No, because it's just sort of like, it's like, dude, that'd be awesome if like Paris is destroyed, which I also had forgotten that Paris is destroyed in this movie. And the movie kind of...
Suck it, France.
The movie's kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
I thought Bruce Willis actually is pretty great in this. I think he's really, really fun. I think he gets... This to me is back in the day when Bay's actors kind of were on the right wavelength of how to treat his movies.
Yeah, like The Rock is another example.
Yeah, because Nicolas Cage gets it totally. Sean Connery gets it sort of perfectly. And I think Bruce Willis also kind of gets it where they're human enough that you believe them as being part of our species, but they're also just elevated enough where they're kind of like Bay-ish in terms of like how ridiculous and over the top they are. I mean, Ben Affleck is a total goofball in this movie. And it's a reminder of like, oh, this is back when people thought that Ben Affleck was going to be around for maybe a year or two. And that'd be sort of the end of it. Liv Tyler definitely deserves the award for how are we supposed to feel about what's happening? Let's cut to Liv Tyler. She looks very concerned. Sometimes she looks worried. Other times she looks upset. And that's what she kind of does sort of throughout this movie. And also I'd forgotten just how much Aerosmith.
Oh my God, so much Aerosmith. So much Aerosmith. Like, again, this is not just like, I don't want to miss a thing or whatever song that is. Like, Sweet Emotion shows up twice. Like, there's so much Aerosmith top to bottom.
I have to say, though, to me, one of the complaints that you'll get as a critic if you don't like one of the Transformers movies is, why can't you just enjoy a movie? You know, why can't you just enjoy something? This, to me, is back when Michael Bay made those types of movies where you could actually enjoy it. It's not great. It's barely good enough. But for 2.5 hours, and it is too long, I actually found it pretty entertaining. And I will admit, I actually found it like surprisingly emotional at the end.
The ending's not bad. The ending is so hacky, and it still kind of works.
It kind of works. Like, I wouldn't say I got, like, weepy. I mean, it wasn't like watching Finding Dory or something, but I did find myself thinking, yeah, this actually kind of works, and Bruce Willis sells it really, really well at the end. So, pleasantly surprised that Armageddon was better than I had remembered.
There's also... Listen, the guy makes hugely popular movies, so this is kind of a weird thing to say. But there's like an eagerness to please here that he's not so calcified in his Michael Bayism, is probably the best way to put it. Like, he's still like, this is him being like, yeah, I'm going to do the things that I do, but I'm really going to make you like it. Like, you know, like there's almost a defiance in like the last couple Transformers movies that like, you know what, I'm not going to make these any better. And if you don't like it, screw off. And this feels, it feels a little eager to please, which it would, and I think it helps it out. It also has, you can tell the difference in like a line in this movie that if it were set in a Transformers movie, I'd want to throw something across the room. Like, remember, there's the Steve Buscemi character, for example. This is literally how he's introduced. They call him Hound because he's horny. That's literally how. And then we cut to him trying to pick up a girl. Like, that's his character trait. Because, of course, when you are thinking of a Lothario who picks up women from all over the place, who else are you going to cast than Steve Buscemi?
Yo, wait, do we have Owen Wilson in this? Let's still have it be Steve Buscemi.
Give it to Buscemi. And he's actually very... I actually kind of like his go crazy turn at the end. I feel like that's like... It's a wrinkle that you don't usually... That Bay would not do anymore.
Yes. You know how we were talking earlier about the whole problem in Finding Dory about octopuses driving cars? This movie has space dementia. That's not a thing, right?
This is insane.
He's got space dementia.
It's funny because, you know, this is the movie famously that inspired a lot of the Team America stuff. Like, they used the line even in Team America where, like, just think about all the worst parts of the Bible. It's just like cheesy lines are, Harry doesn't know how to fail. Like, there's just so many, like, I can't believe you're saying this with a straight face moments that I have to say I found myself against all my better judgment. I've like the names of the spaceships are Independence and Freedom.
Yes. Yes. I have to say, as somebody who sometimes worries about getting names wrong, I would be so panicked. Like, wait, which one was I on? Was this supposed to be Independence or Freedom? Oh, shoot. I can't remember that. Because they're so similar in name. It is
And they're so it's so easy to be for both that there's nothing contrary. So,
I like both concepts. So,
and I also love that like this is like it literally like this movie like just gives you a wait red wire or blue wire red wire or blue wire moment. It doesn't even blink, doesn't even wink at you. It's just like sure, here it is. I agree with you. I feel a little embarrassed to say it, but I really had a great time watching Armageddon.
It's
I
fun,
really
it's, did. And I have to say, in some ways, it validates what I felt about the Transformers movies, which is, yeah, these aren't fun. Like, there's no joy in these. This movie does have fun. Like, this movie actually is joyful and kind of goes, oh, come on. Like, and I think that that's the thing that Bay has lost along the way. He's kind of gained this self-importance where this movie, as grandiose as it is, it doesn't really take itself all that seriously, though. I wish that there were, like, other movies would just have cutaway shots to a meteor hurtling. Like, every once in a while, just... Wow. That sound effect is used over and over again as the meteor gets closer and closer to Earth.
Also, there's like space dust around the like magic space dust around the just in case it didn't look like cool enough, we have to have magic space dust around the rock. Alright, so there is Armageddon. I have to say, it also reminded me how much I enjoyed The Rock. And we've talked about how I think The Rock, we both agree The Rock is his best movie.
Yes.
Yeah, and so it reminded me, it has that same kind of ridiculous feel. So there you go. See, Michael Bay, you're the one that got worse. We used to cut you some slack over here, and you're the problem. All right, so the next movie, our final movie in our reboot section this week, is it Road to Perdition or The Road to Perdition?
It is just Road to Perdition.
This is the life we chose, the life we lead. And there is only one guarantee. None of us will see heaven. Michael could.
Road to Perdition, directed by Sam Mendes, based off a graphic novel, which I've not read. Have you read the graphic novel?
I have not read the graphic novel.
It stars Tom Hanks and Paul Newman, Jude Law, Daniel Craig, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Stanley Tucci. If memory serves me correctly, Grierson, when this movie was people first started talking about this movie, it was sold as the Tom Hanks as a bad guy. Am I wrong? Am I remembering
that's
that incorrectly?
Definitely. I mean, the two things I feel like when it came out that summer of 2002 was, number one, hey, this is the new film from the director of American Beauty that won all those Oscars, and this is Tom Hanks being dark.
Tom Hanks plays kind of this mob enforcer for the mob headed by Paul Newman. Paul Newman has a out-of-control son played by Daniel Craig, who ultimately, because of... Tom Hanks' son, Michael Sullivan, I believe is his character's name. Tom Hanks' son accompanies him on a work event, sneaks in the car, and discovers that his father is, in fact, a mob enforcer and that he has seen a murder take place. All of a sudden, that sets into a whole, all sorts of mob business into motion. And as it turns out... Tom Hanks has to go all vengeful while still protecting his son. Grace, I want you to kind of kick us off a little bit on this with this notion. For all the talk of the time of this being a darker Tom Hanks there are times where Tom Hanks like shoots a dude in the face. I don't remember another movie he's done that. So I'll say he's a little dark. That was not in Philadelphia. That was not in, I believe it might have been in Toy Story, but only in like the deleted scenes.
Right.
Do you think this is a different Tom Hanks performance?
Well, it's almost like, oh, Saving Private Ryan. We didn't see that movie. We missed that one. Was he dark in that? You know, as opposed to Armageddon that we were talking about before, this movie was almost exactly like I remember it the first time. I think Tom Hanks is pretty darn good in this, but that's generally my feeling about Tom Hanks. And the older I get and the older he gets, the more I think he is going to be remembered, I think, as one of those great mainstream big movie star actors. And that's not a backhanded compliment when I say that. He's one of those guys that you can just depend on, plug him into stuff, and he will do a better job than you will expect from that type of performance. He brings a little more nuance, a little more feeling to a role. Well, especially in this case, is actually not that well written. There is not, to me, a sense that that father and that son really kind of bond or learn something about one another. And that's a crucial component, because the movie is bookended by the son narrating his feelings about his father after going on this journey. I think Tom Hanks sells it as best as he can, but there's not much there. What works in this movie, and what makes it still recommendable, I guess, for me, is that I wouldn't say that Sam Mendes shows us anything new about the world of mobsters or honor among thieves or anything like that, but he just sort of production designs the hell out of this thing, where it creates an atmosphere where it's very fun and enveloping to sort of be inside of it. It's a type of movie that when it comes out is reviewed by, it's praised by saying it's meticulously crafted or handsomely mounted, or tech credits are pro if you're writing for a trade publication. It looks like a trillion bucks. It looks really good. Conrad Hall, who died, the cinematographer, won Best Cinematography for it. It looks tremendous. I think the performances are all really solid. Like when Stanley Tucci comes in, he's really good. Everybody's
he's
really
great.
Good.
Jude Law is a little gimmicky.
Yes. I want to get into this, but I want you to start. So, yes.
I think that character is pretty lame, to be entirely honest with you.
Yeah. And for me, it was really a reminder of, in terms of context, this is post-AI. Jude Law was in AI. Mm-hmm. He was in Talented Mr. Ripley, which was sort of like his big, kind of big breakthrough, I feel like, in terms of film.
And he was awesome in that movie.
And he's terrific. I mean, we're both big fans of that movie. And this movie, it very much felt like, hey, it's that great character actor, Jude Law. What great character actor things is he going to do? Oh, he twirls a coin between his fingers, and like he has weird teeth. And I actually wished
he's
I'd had
bald.
Time. And he's like, but he's not just bald. He's like bald in like a weird way that no human being would ever be bald, because he's a psychopath.
This was, I think we have talked about Paul Newman. It was his last movie. We should probably bring that up. He's Paul Newman. He's effortless. I really don't think he has much of a character to play at all. He's not really any different than any other mob kingpin we've kind of seen. And you know, and just the minute you see him, he just looks like the most comfortable person. The thing I always got about Paul Newman, particularly for the last like 20 years of his career, he just was just comfortable the minute they turned the camera on. And that's something that while this is not a great Paul Newman performance, he's not even in it very much. If it's not Paul Newman, that's a pretty empty character.
Yeah, and it's the type of performance that, because he's such a respected elder statesman of Hollywood, he gets nominated for Best Supporting Actor because people just love Paul Newman, but it is pretty, like, that's just sort of like plugging in a persona.
Yeah, I mean, the whole movie feels like way too dignified.
Yes, and that also is the reason why I really wish I could have read the graphic novel, because it definitely, from not reading it, it feels like, well, this graphic novel is very pulpy and all, but what if we took it seriously? And it has that kind of tone to it, like, no, we're gonna elevate this to art. I'm actually looking at the Wikipedia pages we're talking right now. And under the chapter heading of themes, there are three things. Consequences of violence, fathers and sons, a little bit. And the number three, water. Because there's so many scenes of rain in this movie. And that to me is kind of indicative of this movie. Like, things look cool and seem important. And even Thomas Newman's score, which part of it I really like and part of it I really don't like, has that feeling of everybody, let's just have like a stiff upper lip because the emotions are so finely wrought in this film. People will be devastated by the end. I have to ask you, because I remember this when I saw it the first time, did you know Tom Hanks was going to get shot at the moment he gets shot?
I think it's hard not to.
Yeah, because I wanted to know, because I'm not one of those people who is really good at predicting that stuff. And I thought, God, if I can predict this. And I remember back in the day seeing this going, he's going to get shot, right? And
well, I mean, for crying out loud, that shot is held for like 7 seconds.
It's a long time. Like, and that to me is part of what's, though this movie is beautiful, it really feels very glassy. It just feels like, hey, Mr. Mendez, you won an Oscar for American Beauty, a movie, by the way, we should point out, neither of us are big fans of. Nope. And that movie is also
like Kevin Spacey. I like Kevin Spacey in that Benning. Yeah,
and I think that, again, like Conrad Hall makes that movie look gorgeous and gives it more gravitas than maybe it sort of deserves. But this movie especially kind of feels like, everybody be quiet. There are valuable lessons to be learned in this film.
Yes, it needs to be. It's funny, you know who I actually do kind of like in the movie a little bit, that I think the movie could use a little bit more of, is Dylan Baker.
Yes, he's very good in it.
He's very good in it, and he's also kind of funny. Like the movie, and I think Stanley Tucci's like that too. I think the two of them bring like some lightness to a movie that desperately needs it. The last thing I'm going to mention about this movie, Tyler Hoechlin?
Yes, I also wanted to mention this. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. The kid in the movie, he's a grown up now. This movie's 14 years later. He's a grown up now. He is actually playing Superman in the new Supergirl series.
Yes. That's
just announced, I think, in the last like 48 hours.
Yes, and of course, he is also in. Everybody wants some exclamation point.
Awesome. And everybody wants some.
Yes. I did not know that. I did not remember that while watching this. And I thought, oh, he's okay, but he doesn't have, that character is not well drawn. And so I thought, whatever happened to that actor? Clicked on link. Oh, so yes.
All right. So that is Road to Perdition. Thank you for giving that for our reboot section. So Chris, I think we have, I guess, one more podcast. So we're not going to do our top 10, our top six on this podcast, but we'll be doing it on the next one. On the next podcast, but the one after that one, right?
That's correct. Absolutely.
So it's a stacked schedule next week. So we only have one reboot, and the movie we're going to do the reboot of is The Rocketeer. Eventually, we're going to get out of 1990s movies, but we are going to do The Rocketeer, which I believe came out in 1991.
That sounds right. I think that's right.
Was not financially successful, but I think it's still beloved by a lot of people. Kind of a precursor to this superhero comic book world that we have now. So I'm very curious to watch The Rocketeer, directed by Joe Johnston, if memory serves me correctly.
Yes, right? who did the first Captain America movie.
The first Captain America movie. And Jumanji. Did he do Jumanji? I think he did do Jumanji.
I'm going to hope he didn't, but he might. He might.
Let's go look that up. He did do Jumanji. So, yeah. And Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which is actually kind of fun. Anyway, we might be off topic. The point is next week we're going to be talking about The Rocketeer. We'll also be talking about a lot of big releases from the week, including Independence Day Resurgence, which Grierson will be reviewing for us at The New Republic. The Neon Demon, which I will be reviewing for us for The New Republic. Swiss Army Man, which Grayson will be reviewing for us in the New Republic, and I will probably have not seen by the time we do the next podcast, so you'll have to have one of those times where I shut up and Grayson talks. Grayson, how do you feel about 22? Did we do okay?
I think we did great.
I have to say, if you were as critical of movies the way you are of us, you would be...
I am just a very positive person, because we put in 110%, Will. Don't forget.
Yeah, you're a very positive person to us, because we're making this. Like, I imagine if every single reviewer was like, I think it's great. They did everything they did here. I'm very happy with all of it. Good job, them. And that was just your whole review. It would hurt this podcast.
Probably. I every once in a while, there's a Warcraft. And and that makes me very sad.
Which I think is actually the first movie that is actually classified as a war crime. So.
Stop. Just don't. See, this podcast was going so well. Look what happened.
I just got. Grierson just dinked me half a star. All right, Grierson, have a great week.
You too.
Bye. Armageddon. Are you getting it?
Meteor.